Yeah, that works. Works just fine. Hey everyone, this is Rish Outfield. This is a sort of warning about this episode. This episode has been a long time in coming. By the time it sees air, it'll be a year. And I've never had an episode I've wanted to edit less or put out there less. But, you know, why did I record it if not to share it? This is kind of unique where I'm recording. I don't know how to start. I am at my childhood home all by myself. I had some work I needed to do. I mowed the lawns, but I didn't get all the work done I was supposed to. I feel like the sun's going to go down soon, and I wanted to podcast. And if I didn't podcast once it got too dark, then I had failed. I can always clean, take some stuff, load it into the pickup truck to take to the junkyard another day. I don't know. That's me justifying what I've got going on. I've mentioned before the inspirations that I had in starting a podcast. One of them was that radio show that I would listen to in Los Angeles. It was a lonely space of years in LA where I was away from my family, I was away from the things that were familiar, support group, that kind of stuff. And listening to these people talk about their lives, about their day-to-day struggles, I felt like I knew them. I felt like they were my friends. You know, if they were having a hard time, I sympathized. If they succeeded in something, I felt like, wow, good for them. That's awesome. I had succeeded too, or at least a friend of mine had succeeded. And since I started my Patreon, I've paid attention to what other people do for their Patreon accounts. And there's a girl that I've been following and I watch her videos. And she did a video where she talked about the pitfalls of fame, as it were. And by fame, I guess I mean by having strangers listen to what you say, watch you. She's a video person, one of those YouTubers. And she talked about that before she made it big, if you will, and had, you know, thousands of followers and that kind of stuff, she was anonymous and she could just be her. And now that she's succeeded, she's just got too many strangers watching her, talking about her, commenting. It was interesting because she said that the negative comments, you know, people saying mean things, she could handle because she's tough. She doesn't give a crap what people say. I guess she has a job where people complain to her all the time, and she's fine with that. But it was when people complimented her or said things that she found questionable, people acted like they knew her, acted like they were friends, acted like maybe one day they could be more than friends, where she's just like, oh, you know, I don't like that. I don't want that. She started to have problems with that. And you know what? I realized that as a guy, I'm going to have different problems. I'm not going to have that kind of worry that sometimes girls have, maybe all girls have. For me, I wanted people to feel like we were friends. I wanted people to feel like they could send me a message and say, oh, hey, I'm really pushing for you, man, or whatever you say. I'm sorry that you had a hard time, or whatever it is. And maybe that's a mistake. Now, the whole reason I'm recording this right now is because this is the king, the mother of all overshare episodes. I am here at the, I walked all the way to the end of my childhood home property. And I thought it would be great to do a video podcast for once, to actually show people where I grew up. We walked back to the end. It's just a couple acres. I hopefully the sound isn't terrible because I'm going to be walking through grass. It's about knee high because up until last year, there's always been cows back here. Now it's knee high. Knee high to a tall person, actually. It's almost waist high here. There are no more cows. This episode is going to be about the loss of my father. I don't have a therapist. I don't see a psychologist, any of that stuff. I have a podcast. And so the day that he passed away, I turned on the recorder and talked. And the last thing I wanted to do was edit that and put that out there. But it's come. This is that episode. And so what I did is I walked out here, out in the field. It's a beautiful day. The sun's about to go down. It's warm. And I wish I'd brought my sunglasses, but I set them down and I forgot to pick them up, and now here I am. And I thought it would be interesting to record it, video it, to show myself walking. There's just simply no way. I don't have a selfie stick. I don't have a video camera. I don't have anything. But I have a laptop. I turned it on. I pointed it out here. And here I am walking toward it. It may work. It may not. If it works, I will stick that part on the blog. If it doesn't work, you've got a podcast. This is where I grew up. My parents built a house here in 1977. I was young enough in 77 to barely remember anything before that. So this is pretty much my childhood right here, is this house, this property. This pasture where I am, once I got old enough, like 11, 12 years old, I got to participate, had to participate in the irrigation that would happen every summer. And once I got old enough to do it myself, I would have to come out here and pull the little dams so that all of this field got irrigated. And I would be so afraid out here on my own because my imagination was worse than it is now, of just, you know, imagining something crawling through the grass at me. Oh, often the irrigation water came in the middle of the night. And so I'd come out here. It would be dark. I'd have a flashlight. And I imagined all sorts of awful things. But none of those awful things ever happened. Pretty much all of my memories for this place, the sound of that cricket, are positive to me. I hated living here sometimes, but now that that's all over, I think of it fondly. And this house is empty, and this is only the second time I've come out here by myself. God, that noise, huh? You can hear me walking through dry grass. This is only the second time I've done this, and it's weird to be here by myself. I hear all of the noises. You hear those crickets? And birds? And a plane? And occasionally dogs? My uncle brought a horse over here a couple weeks back, but it's obviously not here anymore. It's just an empty pasture. And someday, soon, we're going to sell this house. Because nobody wants to live here. It's just too remote. And so I won't be able to come out here and do this. I will never again climb over this fence. I used to jump over this fence as a little kid. I'd just run and jump, and now I'm too fat. Now it's scary. You can hear somebody on a motorcycle. It's the kind of town this is. Anyhow, I don't know if it's smart or stupid to share this episode with you. If you think, you know, that's too much of a share, that's too private, that's too personal, you shouldn't be sharing that kind of stuff, then turn it off as soon as I turn off my intro. It's okay. If not, well then, I guess we're both going to suffer together. That's what I wanted. I wanted people to feel like they knew us, like they were our friends. You don't get much closer than this. So experiment all over. This is the backyard, the lawn I just finished mowing. That is the tin garage. That's my dad's truck garage. Over there was a chicken coop. The pink palace, as my mom always called it. Over there is where the barn is. You can't see it in the video. The other chicken coop, the one from my childhood, the wood pile. And the house. It's a lot of work getting this place ready to go. But I'm going to miss it when it's gone. Hopefully somebody will love this house. Some like retired couple or something like that. There's like, oh, it's so remote and quaint. And look out there. I don't know how high a quality the video is, but there's our fence at the end of our property. And then after that, nobody, no neighbors. There's a mountain 3 miles away. And beyond that mountain is a larger mountain. No neighbors. I don't know how many miles. 100 miles? In that direction. So at night, it gets so dark and so quiet. It would just be kind of amazing. You can't see it here. The trampoline was always set up here just right off the lawn. And my friends and I, we would come out and we would sit on the trampoline, sleep out on the trampoline sometimes and just stare up at the stars. I'll miss that. I mean, I haven't done that in 20-something year, 25 years. I don't know how long it's been. I haven't walked out to the end of the property in 20 years. More than that. Do you hear that? That was a horse. This was an experiment. I have no idea if it worked or not. I'm not comfortable on camera. I like to podcast. I like to do stuff with my voice. I can do fake Sean Connery without having to think about it. But I don't like seeing myself. It's a different skill set. It's a different mindset. But I thought I would try. At the very least, I will enjoy seeing this. Either seeing, wow, I was fat in those days, or, oh, you know, I wasn't as fat. But that's it for my intro. Thanks for coming with me on this journey. Good late afternoon / evening. Did they just say we weren't able to save the video? Oh, well, if that's the case, then... Hey, folks, this is Rish Outfield, and this is the Rish Outcast. And part of the advantage of this show is that I just record it when I'm in the car. Sometimes I just talk without thinking about where the conversation, the subject is going. And it's easy. The disadvantage of that is that I don't know what to air in what order. I don't have a sense of urgency with the show. Just put things out when I feel like it. And sometimes, as is the case with the last episode I edited, it's a long time overdue and dated. And so case in point, I did an episode earlier this year that I called Travels with Father. It was mostly just, I think it was me talking about getting the car I'm in now. I bought a new car, and I think it was probably about him and the chickens and finding out that he would go to this Western convention every single year, and how familiar that was to me, that my dad had more in common with me than I realized. And he so looked forward to this thing every year. It's a convention that they do in Monument Valley. I think that's what you call it, down there where John Ford shot a bunch of his movies, where a lot of Westerns were filmed over the years. And my dad just loves the Western genre and those movies, and he would look forward to going on this trip every year, to the point where a couple of days before it was time for his trip, he had had a long-standing appointment
at the doctor's office, and the doctor had canceled on him back in March. And months had gone by, and it was the end of July, I believe. No, it was the end of August. And the doctor said, come on in, and we'll reschedule this. We'll finally take a look at you. And my dad went in there, and the doctor said, you know, there's something wrong with your heart. You really need surgery. You need triple bypass surgery. And that's not to say that this came as a huge surprise. Apparently, my dad had been weak and dizzy and not feeling well for a while. But he's stubborn, and he doesn't like to go to the doctor. A big thing about him is he doesn't like to be told what to do. And the doctor said, no, you know, you need that surgery. You ought to have it right now. We can schedule it for tomorrow. And my dad said, no, I've got this thing that I go to, and my friend is counting on me. He's down there already, and I was going to meet him. And I do it every year, and I will come back afterward and have that surgery. And he went, despite the doctor's protestations. And listen, that felt familiar to me. I can be stubborn in that way, and there have been, even recently, times when it's like, I really want to go to my convention, even though I don't have a lot of money, or even though it's irresponsible or something. But I look forward to it every year. That's what I'm going to do. And he went. And he had the surgery, and it didn't go well. He never left the hospital. He was there a long time. And he got sick, and then he seemed to be getting better. And then he got really bad, and it was hard to see him. It was hard. I didn't recognize him. And then he started getting better again. And then he took a turn for the worse, and he was done. He didn't want to do it anymore. He had said that early on. In fact, I almost want to say it was 3 days or 4 days after the surgery, he said, better start planning my funeral. My dad is so stubborn and so tough that it's hard to know how to take things like that. He said some kind of awful things. But you know what? I say awful things sometimes. And do I mean them? Sometimes I do, sometimes I don't. Anyhow, this last weekend, he looked like he was making serious recovery. We went in on Sunday, and I spent a lot of time with him. The longest I had spent since he got sick, and that was pretty much it. The next morning, he had a very bad episode, and the doctor, there was a very, very blunt doctor who came in, and a part of me wants to tell the whole story in detail because, you know, this is kind of a journal entry. This is Travels with Father, Part 2. But at the same time, it's just like, well, gosh, how deep do I go? How intimate do I go? The doctor didn't think he would survive yesterday morning and was blunt about it. And it was shockingly so. He was a little too brusque. He was... I'm not sure that I like that doctor. But he pulled through. It surprised the doctor. The doctor came in 7 hours later or 6.5 hours later and was surprised to still see my dad alive and started talking to him about the future. And at this point, my dad couldn't talk, but he was nodding. He was aware of people that are in the room. I went to bed last night, and an hour and 10 minutes after I went to bed, I got the call that he had taken another turn and that it was bad, that I should wake my sister up and drive over. And we did, and we had to make that decision. You know which decision I'm talking about. It's a hard decision to make. But at this point, today, marked 1 month since he had the surgery. And boy, that cost a lot of money, and it was a tremendous amount of suffering. And if he had had his way, he would have been let go weeks ago. And so we did let him go, and he died today. And I have to admit that I was very useless during most of the process. I never felt like I could contribute anything. I'm not as close to my dad as my brother is, for certain. And my sisters had a much tighter relationship with him. And my mom was there and very stalwart at his side and patient. Whatever two steps beyond patient is. But not me. I'm not useful in that way. Except for today, I got to be useful. Today, I stepped up and I said, okay, well, let's call some people. Let's text some people. Let's let them know what's happened. And let's plan first the obituary. We'll write that together. And then we're going to plan the funeral. And I sort of got to take charge and serve a purpose. And that was good. You know, it sucks. I feel a bit embarrassed, although not nearly as embarrassed as I might one day listening to this. But it's easy to make something like this all about you. I felt this. I worried about this. I thought this. I hoped this. Well, that's just natural. That's human nature. I can't be hard on myself for that, because everybody sees life myopically. Everybody experiences life through their own lives, through their own eyes. And today I got to serve a purpose. I guess I said that. And that was nice. Very tired. And I was driving, and I was like, you know what, I'm going to record this, and we'll see where it goes, and we'll see how detailed I go, and still don't know. I still haven't decided how detailed I need to be. Although, boy, if this is conservative, can you imagine what a very revealing Rish Outcast would be, huh? So, I've reached the end of today. I'm on my way home. Pretty tired. I was kind of arrogant in thinking that I could have a day like today where, A, I had no sleep. Okay, you know, 50 minutes or whatever. And two, you know, it has to be some kind of stress. It has to be some kind of effect on the human psyche. Two, be awakened with bad news and rushing to the hospital, seeing somebody that you care about deteriorating, suffering, being given the choice of what to do about it. Yeah, basically, I guess I should fill in that part of the story. But the point I was trying to make was that there was the stress of that. There was the stress of, okay, what do we do now? Of seeing members of the family break down, or at least in much more emotional turmoil than I was, planning all of this stuff, you know, things that I think it would be stressful to do an obituary normally. It would be stressful too, because I had to have it done by 4 o'clock in the afternoon, because that was the deadline to get it in the paper for tomorrow. And, you know, to plan the funeral and to contact family members. It's funny, I texted my uncle in Las Vegas at 6 something in the morning telling him what had happened. And I guess he had gotten a new phone or had lost all of the contacts. So he had no idea who I was with this news. And he texted me back. The text, under other circumstances, would be quite amusing. It said, "I'm sorry to hear that. Who are you?" But I didn't see that text. So he called a couple minutes later, and when I answered, he was surprised to hear my voice. He didn't know who had sent him that text. My mom had turned off her phone when it came time for us to make this decision. So let me go to that. Basically, the ventilator was keeping him going, as well as a ton of medications, IVs, drips, sedatives, painkillers, blood, whatever the opposite of a blood thinner would be, I think, because his blood pressure was low and they were giving him injections to keep the blood pressure up, and they were giving him stuff for his stomach. They were giving him... I took a picture of it. In fact, it's the only picture I took at the hospital in this last month. I guess I wish that I had thought to take a picture of him on one of the good days, sitting in the bed or standing or walking or whatever it might be, because there you go, you would have that, and now I won't. But you didn't want to take a picture of him in the hospital. He was I'm not going to say he was a vain man, but he was upset whenever he had facial hair, when he had, you know, he wasn't clean shaven. He was upset whenever his hair hadn't been combed the way that he liked it. He was also upset that he was there long enough that his hair started getting long. And, you know, my dad lived through the 60s, and there was almost nothing he hated more than a hippie. So, you know, he wasn't a fan of long hairs. And in fact, any time growing up I started to grow my hair out, he would always make a crack of, you know, I didn't know I had a daughter. He always had a pet peeve about long hair. But so the point was, I wouldn't have thought to take a picture of him not looking his best. And the one picture that I did take was all of the drips and medications and bags, you know, there's saline and there was some kind of glucose type thing for blood sugar, and I mean, several machines hooked up to each one of these IVs or drips. I don't know medical terms at all, and I'm afraid I didn't learn any new medical terms. I know I learned what a shunt was. I learned that he had an adverse reaction to Ativan. But I took a picture of this thing because there were just so many chemicals that were keeping him going. And the doctor came in and said, we've leveled off his blood pressure. It should be at, I don't know, 90 or something like that. No, 90 is his oxygen level. I'm going on no sleep. I'm not... for a podcaster, I kind of need a sharp mind. I at least need to be able to articulate what's going on in my head. So today is probably not the best day. Tonight is probably not the best night to be doing this, except for it's now. It's immediate. It is today. The doctor said his body is not producing any urine, which indicates kidney problems, could be kidney failure. We've taken a test, some kind of test. We're going to get the results soon. But if his kidneys are failing, then, you know, we're going to have to put him on dialysis and such things. He'd had problems with the lungs. He'd had problems with his stomach. It was a domino effect, or a game of whack-a-mole. I don't know. Whatever it was, where as soon as you've taken care of one problem, a new problem arose. And my sister was insistent, no, he doesn't want to go on dialysis. No, he doesn't want any more heroic procedures. There was a crash cart in the room. And the doctor said, okay, so if his heart were to cease to function, you wouldn't want us to do CPR. And my aunt had gone through it with her sister with the CPR, with the cracking of ribs and all that. And they still lost her sister. And the weird thing is, this was so long ago. This was 30 years ago. And yet she still described it as though it were fresh in her mind. She said, no, please. And so they took out the crash cart, and the doctor said, okay, well, we need to talk about the plan then, what you would like to do. And we said, well, what are the options? The options for making him comfortable, for letting the pain cease, for the suffering to end. And I have the sister who wasn't handling it as well, who said, why are we even talking about this? No, don't. He's not ready. I'm not ready. He's going to get better. And she'd been saying this for a long time. And so the doctor said, listen, we've got the tests that we've run. Let's talk again when the results of the tests come in. And my sister, who is a nurse, could already see, and she saw it before the rest of us saw it, but she saw that his skin was starting to yellow. And that meant, I guess, that, you know, that he was jaundiced, that there were liver problems or kidney problems. I think liver problems cause jaundice. Again, I was reminded at this late age of my life how little I actually know about medicine, about the human body, about what the organs do. But we discussed it. The doctor had other things to do. Even though it was the middle of the night, he had other patients and stuff. So he moved on, and we discussed it. And, you know, my sister did not want to let him go. She wasn't ready to let him go. I think had she had her way, he would have been there days, if not weeks, longer. And you know, that's not a criticism of her. She had a hope that he would get better, that the rest of us were losing or had lost. Apparently my sister, the one that was the nurse, thought that we had made him suffer a great deal over the last month for nothing. That we should have let him go when he first asked to be let go. And she was angry and frustrated, and that was how she was dealing with this loss, with this realization of the imminent loss. My brother and I discovered that my brother and I were similar in that we stood there and then later sat there stoically trying to process everything, keep any emotions in check, be the pillars, be the support for the people around us. And you know what? I'm probably talking out of my ass. I don't know my brother from your brother. Maybe it wasn't like that at all. Maybe the way he felt was completely different than the way I felt. In fact, I wouldn't be surprised, because my brother was always a lot like my dad, and I felt like I was always a lot like my mom, and they weren't similar people. But anyway, the decision was made, except for my sister, by my sister, that people wanted to pull the plug right then. And the concession was made, for my sister's sake, to wait until those test results came in. We had a nurse who was very, very patient and empathetic and generous with explanations and time. And he told us, you know, about how much time it would be before we got those results. And so it was like, okay, we're going to wait until those results come in. And then if they are dire, as the doctor warned us they might be, then that would be our answer. Something happened while we were waiting for the tests. Whoever calls for these things, and you know what, it could have been from hours before, they started to bring an x-ray machine into the room. And the nurse went out and talked to these technicians, and they said, oh, okay, sorry. And I saw him do the universal symbol for kill, you know, the hand under the across the throat. The line from Guardians of the Galaxy. And so the x-ray technicians were like, oh, okay. And they took away the machine. And the results came back that it was way worse than they had anticipated. They had said, okay, it's going to my guess is it's going to be bad. But the kidneys, there was absolutely no kidney function. If we were going to continue to keep him going, we would have to put him on a transplant list. They talked about, they used the word necrosis. They talked about the spread of infection. They talked about white count and where white count was supposed to be and where white count was yesterday. And then this gigantic number where the white count was today. You know what I mean? It's like when you hear the legal alcohol limit, you know, is 0.02% or something like this. And this guy was 0.3%, you know, some crazy number like that where you're like, oh, really? Can a person even function? Are they even conscious at 0.3%? And that's what it was. It was so high or bad or infected or necrotic that he should have already gone. So we had a couple of options of how to relieve his suffering. There was the option of what this one will be the fastest, which involved removing the breathing tube. And there was the option, this will be the most painless, you know. And then there was a third option that was just kind of like, okay, you know, I think we could give him a good deal of morphine, sort of an in-between. It's, you know, it's going to be quick, not going to be the quickest. It's going to be painless. It's not going to be the most painless. My sister seemed to think that there was a Goldilocks solution that would be most painless and quickest, but that was not the case. Again, in deference to her, we chose the painless option, which was leaving the breathing tube in and letting it be a little slower. They unhooked this insane number of medications, blood regulators, everything but the sedative, injected him with morphine, and let the breathing tube continue. Oh, see, that was the third option, was that you turn off, you leave the breathing tube in, but you turn it off. And what we chose was the breathing tube is still doing its job, but the life prolonging measures would be stopped. And, you know, immediately the blood pressure started going down. It was a little bit like a countdown, like a rocket launch countdown. It was fast, but not as fast as it would have been without that breathing tube going. Now, see, my sister really desperately did not want to see him gasping for air, struggling. And, you know, I understand that. I realize this whole episode is an overshare, but I'm going to leave a couple of details out because there was still a little bit of that, even with the breathing tube in, and it was distressing to see. But the numbers started going down. And again, this was not a... this was over a period of several hours that it took for all this to happen, because once we had made a decision, then the doctor had to be called from the other patients that he was visiting. And when he was finished with them, he could come and talk to us. And then an order was given, and it took a little while for that order to be carried out. And then it took a little while for that to take effect. But the numbers started to go down, and it's strange. I watched it as though it was a campfire, as though it was a television, as though it was something to watch. I don't know where it started. I want to say that it started in the 70s and started going down, but it could have started in the 80s and started going down. It got down to the 30s, slowly, step by step, going down to the 20s. It got to 17 and then just stopped. It, you know, as they say, it flatlined. And I was surprised by that. I thought it would continue to go until it got to 1. Yeah, because that's how the rocket launch countdown works. But once it got to 17, it was over. And the nurse said, okay, that's it. There was other stuff. The monitors had a shitload, pardon my French, of alarms attached to them. You know, if the heart rate changed, if the oxygen level changed, if the breathing rate changed, if the blood pressure changed, you know, an alarm would go off. And the nurse had come around, and he was trying to turn all of these to what was called comfort mode, which is a very nice way of saying we're allowing the patient to expire. Please don't blare this alarm. But there were so many of them that that he wasn't able to turn them all off in time, and the alarms just kept going. So that was another thing to watch rather than my dad. Anyway, got to 17 and just choof, the standard that, you know, that you've seen in 1,000 movies and TV shows of the lines going straight, and that was it. His body was so sick, had fought for so long, it was so weak and so riddled with infection and disease and mortality that it went that fast. They called it, as they say, and escorted us out of the room. I guess it was time to clean him up, and we all went into the hall, and I got a chair for my sister, and she didn't even use it. She just sat on the floor. But we were all there together, and that was when suddenly I got to be useful. And when I started texting people and letting them know, and we started talking about the obituary, and luckily nobody bit my head off, because it would have been understandable if somebody's like, how can you talk about this stuff right now? What kind of unfeeling shit are you? But that didn't happen. I think they understood that I was trying to focus us on something positive. And so, yeah, we went through the whole thing, and I got my notebook out, and we eventually went in this little waiting room, conference room. Again, it was pre-dawn, so there was almost nobody else around. And we could do this and just, you know, everybody talked about my sister died, or when this happened, or this was what the obituary was like, or this was what the program was like, or this is what we did. And, you know, where it would, does he have a cemetery plot? You know, which funeral home do we go to, and all that stuff. And I think that everyone had held off on that talk before, maybe for the benefit of those of us who didn't realize he wasn't going to get better. I didn't know until my mom called me this morning and said, you need to come down here. He's taken a bad turn, and this is it. Until she called me, I thought, no, you know, he's going to get better. Yesterday, my aunt told me, I was talking about a conversation that I'd had with him about going to watch them shoot a Western movie. I mean, many, many miles away when he was a younger guy. And she said, oh, did you know that he was an extra in a movie. Yeah, there was a war movie, and he went up there, and he got to be an extra in it. And I was like, no, I didn't know that. She's like, oh, I'm sorry, I don't remember what the movie was or when it was, you know, who was in it or anything, except for that it was a war movie. And I thought, oh, shoot, I'm never going to know what that was. And then he had his miraculous recovery last night. And I thought, oh, my gosh, I'm going to be able to ask him about that. In fact, I talked to him about it when he was unable to talk, but he was not coherent. What's the word? Where he's alert and cogent. I don't know. Anyway, I said, oh, hey, your sister told me that you were an extra in a movie, and I paid my rent for about a year being an extra, and you'll have to tell me about it. I didn't know that. And because I thought we would have the chance to have that conversation. And we didn't. We won't. There was conversation yesterday about, did he keep a journal? Did he write up his history? Does he have any writings of what his childhood was like or what his memories were? And nobody seemed to think that he did, even though a couple of years ago he wrote up a fairly extensive history about his dad, about his dad's war time service, about, you know, the various jobs that he had and things like that. And things that I didn't know, and maybe a lot of people didn't know, but he had, you know, interviewed the people that knew him and enough to write this history. And I typed it all up, and boy, he was a stickler. You know, he had a whole ton of changes that he wanted made on that manuscript. But I'm not going to be able to ask him about any of that stuff. I could have. But at the same time, this was a good year for me and my dad, for our relationship. Because we had conversations. We went to the cabin, you know, and talked. He helped me pick out this car that I'm sitting in. Yeah, we had a few conversations. And of course, it was almost always about movies. The one thing that we had in common. But that's good, you know, to have anything in common. You know, you want to focus on that. I should go on, because this is a journal entry. This is an important document. Right now, even though I'm very tired, this is the closest I'm going to be to it. And maybe that's not a good place to be podcasting from speaking from. Maybe it would be better after a full night's sleep. Maybe it would be better after some time for it to sink in and for things to settle, straighten themselves out in my head. But, you know, that's not the decision I made. I chose to go somewhere, to go for a drive, even though I was tired and emotionally probably upset or spent or in upheaval. Partly because I knew I could record these things and put into words some of the things I was feeling. And that's good. So that last recording was, there's a word for it. Not sure what it is. Intimate? An overshare? TMI. People, oh gosh, do you remember when that was supposed to be funny? I saw an online rant the other day about when people say really as though that's a punchline. And it never really occurred to me that people say that way, but they do. And then he showed a montage of comedians doing it and people on sitcoms doing it. And then that Saturday Night Live thing that Seth Meyers and Amy Poehler used to do. Although, in their defense, they would have a joke besides just saying, really? He showed a stand-up comedian, and I think she said it 4 or 5 times in a row. You know, really? 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 And the audience just howled with laughter the whole time. And that sucks. That just breaks my heart that kind of stuff could be considered comedy. I mean, because, dude, A speak and spell could do that. There's absolutely no talent or creativity or timing. Well, maybe there's timing. Anyway, I digress. This is probably an outtake. It's weird. I'm tired. I shouldn't be. I went to sleep last night way earlier than I have gone to sleep when I've not been sick in a long time. In fact, let me clarify. I went to sleep so early that I set my alarm for 5 a.m. Because in my experience, if you don't sleep enough, you're tired. But if you sleep too much, you're also tired. You mess up your biological clock or something. And so I set my alarm for that early. And of course it went off and it was pitch black. And I was like, So I switched it to go off a little while after that, and that went off as then. And I looked around, and it was still dark. And I was like, I don't get up when it's dark. Sorry, that's my sleepy voice. So I still ended up getting up way earlier than I usually get up unless it's for some purpose. But it's a few hours later, and now I'm feeling tired. And that just shouldn't be. That's sad. But this is Travels with Father Part 2, right? My dad passed away on Tuesday. And I busied myself with plans for the obituary, which had to be in at 4 o'clock that day. And then plans for the viewing and the funeral. And I would never have guessed that planning a funeral would be so much work or so much headache, I guess. And I think I talked a little bit about this on the last episode, but boy, I was tired. I'm way more tired than I am now. I was going on no sleep then, and now I'm going on too much sleep. Oh, sad. But there were arguments about who should be a pallbearer and who should be an honorary pallbearer and what an honorary pallbearer was, and so-and-so should be on, well, not so-and-so. And he's like, well, okay, but what is an honorary pallbearer? That was the question that I asked a bunch of people. What is the purpose of an honorary pallbearer? And there's no answer. In fact, if you're like, oh, I know what an honorary pallbearer is, I'm about to call you the F word, okay? Just prepare. You're the F word. No, you don't. You don't know what an honorary pallbearer is because no one knows. I was told, okay, well, traditionally, you'd have some strong men who could carry the casket. And then you would have honorary people listed who were too old or too infirm or too young to carry the casket. And that's what an honorary pallbearer was. But it's not that anymore. Now it has become something else, a special thanks, a nod to those who are close to the family, just a way of appreciating those that are not part of the funeral itself, or maybe, again, the honorary pallbearer does nothing. They don't do anything. So why are they only men? Why can't a woman be an honorary pallbearer? Because it doesn't mean anything. And I'm sorry, I'm getting angry. But I had so many arguments about, well, we shouldn't have people from mom's side of the family as honorary pallbearers. It should all be people from dad's side of the family. And, oh, this guy was an asshole, so he shouldn't be an honorary pallbearer. And he's like, well, you've got two kids from this family, but not the third. And that's not fair to the third. And it's like, well, what if somebody came down to the funeral and they're not on the list as an honorary pallbearer? Well, that's not fair. And there were actually arguments about it. And I guess from my reaction right now, from the way I'm podcasting right now, clearly I have issues. Still, I have emotional baggage that I'm carrying around that I haven't sat down. And partly it's been because I have been so busy. I mean, all of us have. The whole family has been doing. My brother took care of doing the death certificate, letting all of the insurance companies know, and
Social Security, I guess, Medicare, you know, all that legal stuff. He took care of that. My mom had my sisters help her with the flowers, picking out the flower arrangements, which, again, I would not have considered to be a big deal, but holy monkey, it was a big deal. So much. And pardon me if any of this is offensive to you. I don't mean for it to be. Some of it inevitably might be because it's personal. It's and there's stress and there's emotion attached. But the flowers, I can give you the benefit of the doubt that an honorary pallbearer is important. But the amount of money wasted on the flowers is, I'm not going to say incomprehensible. There's a word stronger than incomprehensible, and it's unjustifiable. We, not just my family, but my sister's work, my brother's work, my uncle's family, my aunt's family, another aunt's family, some of the nephews, spent enough money on flowers that if you pooled that money together, you could buy a car. And it wouldn't be a rust bucket car. It was something that my mom was saying yesterday, because after all of the funeral stuff was done, we had to go back to the church to get flowers and pictures, and we had to go back to the cemetery to get all those flowers or the things that we didn't want just to be thrown away. And she said, gosh, it's such a waste. It's so much money, and they're already wilting. And anyhow, agree with me or disagree with me, it just, I guess the flowers are a tradition, but wow. So another thing that I had volunteered for was to deliver the, I guess they call it the tribute. So I put together the funeral. You know, who would give a prayer? What would the songs be? Is it okay if there's songs? Like, so my sisters were really, what's the word? They felt strongly that John Denver's Back Home Again should be the song that my dad would like performed at the funeral. And so that night, I looked up Back Home Again, and on the surface, it seemed great. Hey, it's good to be back home again. Sometimes this old farm feels like a long lost friend. Something like that. It's nice. But what the song is actually about is a truck driver who is on his way home, and he can't wait to be with his woman. He can't wait to feel her fingers on his skin. I think undulating buttocks might be part of the song. It's, you know, it's a dude who's been away from home too long, and he needs his woman, and that's what's keeping him going. And yeah, the second he gets there, it's going to stop being a John Denver song, and it's going to start becoming a Barry White song. So I said, no, sorry, I will take the pertinent lines from that song out, and we'll put them on the back of the funeral program. And I designed the funeral program and typed it up and all that stuff and got it printed. And there was still an error. And I don't understand how this stuff happens, because I typed it. Okay. And even if you don't know that I'm a writer, that's my thing is the English language, why would you go to the effort of retyping the obituary and the you know, the speaker's names and all that stuff? Why? Because it's just a ton of extra work for you. Why not just copy and paste into your template or into, you know what I'm saying? So the funeral home got the birthplace of my dad wrong. And, you know, I said, oh, hey, guys, I called up there, and oh, they had an answering service. And so I was telling the woman everything, and because I thought she was, what she said was, I'm assisting with phone calls. And I was like, oh, okay, yeah, that's fine. And I told her the whole thing, and finally she's like, well, I'm not who you think I am. I'm just an answering service. I'm just taking his phone calls and then getting him the messages of who he needs to call back. You know, you told me the whole story.
But I don't work for the funeral home. I'm just an answering service. And, you know, I wanted to become Adam Sandler. You know, that would have been useful information 8 minutes ago. But anyway, I asked him, I said, I need you to change the birthplace. He put the wrong one. And he gave me a reason for why he, oh, sorry, I confused. But again, there should have been no thought involved at all on the funeral director's part. It should have been copied and pasted. But I did put the non-sexual lines from Back Home Again on the back of the program. I don't know. It's turned out that there was also, there not a lot, not enough that I should be stressed over it, but there was a little bit of politics involved. Not to the extent of the honorary pallbearers, but we picked someone to, I don't know, officiate, moderate, conduct the funeral. Then we were told no, we'd been overruled by that, that somebody else wanted to do it. And I don't know. We were asking people to participate in different ways. And like, I think I mentioned to you before, maybe not, maybe that episode never got edited, but there's an opera singer that lives next door to my mom, to my mom's house. And often when I'm over there or mowing the lawn, or I'll hear him singing. He practices or whatever. And he does it inside, indoors, but you can hear it across the street through the windows. And he came over to my mom's place and said, you know, oh, I would be happy to sing something. And so we asked him to sing, but then later, my cousin's dad, who was, oh, okay, hey, remember Old Man River? That episode that I did? My piano teacher / singing instructor had a ton of kids, and one of his daughters married my cousin. And so he's part of my mom's family by marriage. And so he wanted to participate too. He wanted to sing or do something, but the neighbor had already said. But the thing is, my dad didn't know the neighbor of my mom, but my dad did know the guy who was my piano teacher and who was the father-in-law of my cousin. So I wanted there to be a way for him to participate. And, you know, what do you do? So I had him be in charge of like the music and, you know, the person that leads the music. When I typed it, I found out that the word is chorister. So I had him do that. But he also played sad music, like while we were all in the family get together, you know, when closing the casket and having our last moments and stuff. So I feel like he got to participate. But in the back of my mind, I was like, whoops, because he's actually closer to the family. Gosh. But again, the question needs to be asked, who is the funeral for? We've already thrown out the who are the honorary pallbearers for, because the answer is, who knows? But who is the funeral for? And something that my dad said years and years and years, he had some stock sayings, things that my dad would say, and you'd hear them again and again. And it's interesting because they got brought up at the funeral. My brother and my sisters heard the same things that I heard over and over again. And one of the things Dad used to say was, funerals are for the living. They're not for the dead. In other words, whatever the deceased would have wanted is less important than what the living mourners want, because they're the ones that have to hear it. Now, whether you believe in a life after death or not, that makes a lot of sense. We tried to pick songs that my dad had a connection to. We tried to tailor make it for something that he would have enjoyed, but he notoriously hated long funerals. And he would say,
45 minutes is about good for a funeral. Anything over an hour is too long.
And that's, if you know, knew my dad, that's a good impression of him. My dad impression, some people have gone, whoa, wow, how did you do that? That's how my dad talked. And yeah, if ever you hear a character in an audiobook that I do that does that voice, I chose to do them as my dad. But as I was putting the funeral together, I volunteered to do what we called the tribute, but a lot of people call the eulogy. And I wasn't super close to my dad for a lot of my life. We were at odds for a long time. So I asked my whole family, if you want me to say anything, I will read a message from you. And it ended up being an embarrassment of riches. My mom wrote something up. My sister texted me several things. My brother wrote something up. My dad's friend from college wrote, and one of his former students, he was a teacher before I was born, wrote something up. My aunt wrote a lot. My cousin, who lived across the street from my dad and has her whole life, wrote something up. And then my other sister wrote up basically her own talk. Or talk, is that what you call it? A speech. It was so long that I started feeling, well, I tried to go as fast as I possibly could on her part because it was long. I didn't want to do this. It's complicated. Give me just a second to sort out what I'm trying to say. I felt like it was something that I could do because I have no problem with public speaking. It's something that I feel comfortable with, but also feel or felt like I was very good at. Later, I found out that people that I wasn't as good as I thought I was. But I said that I'll do this because there are a lot of people that can't. They just stand up and they'd cry or they'd be embarrassed to stand up or they'd be afraid. You know, you've heard it said. And if you haven't, I'm about to tell you something that you should have heard a long time ago. People are more afraid of public speaking than they are of death. But not me. So I volunteered to do this and I volunteered to collect everybody's feelings, thoughts, memories, messages, stories, and put it together. And then I was going to do my own in addition to it. And I was grateful that I had so much to work with because I didn't have to say much at all. And so basically what I did was I had a couple of paragraphs at the beginning where I explained, you know, who I was and that my relationship with my dad was not as close as it should have been. And I was learning all sorts of new things in the last month about him that I didn't know. And that luckily I had these other voices I got to speak for. And then I told a little story at the end. And then I sang a song. Because right after my dad passed, we all went into the hall of the hospital. And Mom said, you know, when we lived, well, years ago, your dad always wanted this guy who taught music. He was the music teacher at the high school where Dad and Mom taught. And he always wanted him to sing this song, Old Shep, at my dad's funeral. And why my dad would have talked about his funeral 40 years ago, I don't know. But maybe that's something that you do. And I think that's really cool. It's remarkable that my mom remembered that all these years later. It's more than 40 years, I think, since he would have said that. And she said, well, but unfortunately, that music teacher probably died 20 years ago. And I said, okay, well, I'll do that. I will find that song and I will learn it and I will sing that. And that's how I ended my tribute, my talk. And I started by saying, I didn't want to do this. And I hope that that doesn't come out wrong. Let me elaborate on that. I didn't want to write the talk. I kept putting it off. On one of the nights, I thought, okay, well, I'm going to look up this song. And it was an old cowboy type song from the 30s. I want to say 1938. And it became this song that a bunch of people covered. You know, many, many artists would do it. And I saw Johnny Cash do a version. Most famously, I guess Elvis Presley did a version in 1959. And the lyrics were a little bit different in every version. It's about a boy and his dog, his faithful dog, Shep. And then the dog gets old, and the doctor says, you know, he's I can't do anything more for the dog. And so in one version, the boy has to shoot his dog. And in another version, the boy aims his rifle, and he can't do it. He throws the rifle down. And I just thought that that was interesting, that there were those different versions. I mean, all of them had differences. The first line of the song is when I was a boy and old Shep was a pup, over mountains and valleys we'd roam. Is it over rivers and valleys we'd roam? Well, some people sing meadows. Anyway, so the very first line, there were differences. Anyway, I just had to choose what I felt like was the definitive thing, and I decided not to address the shooting of the dog at all. So I cut out that part, and I just did the part where the doctor says the dog, I can't do anything for him, and then the boy goes to the dog, and they have their goodbyes. And boy, I was worried, because I was trying to teach this song to myself, and now I sort of understand how Big feels when I write a song for us to do on the Doonstief, because sometimes he's never heard this song before, and I'm expecting him to just sing it with me or do his part. Anyway, it was hard for me to learn the song because I couldn't remember how it started. The words were fine, the words I had in front of me, but the tune kept eluding me to the point where I just had my phone with me, and I put it on my phone so that I could carry it around and practice it, or so that I could play it before I stood up to talk. And yeah, I was just so afraid that my mind would go blank, because I had this entire talk, this speech, an insanely long talk. It's like, what if I get to the end and I can't remember how the song goes? How embarrassing. So I wrote that into the talk, you know, that one of the things I do really well is embarrass myself. So we're about to find out how good I still am. And that's nice. I also, when I was putting together the talk, some people had funny stories and some people were really, really somber. And so I tried to have a mix of that. So it was up and down, you know what I mean? And get some laughter, and then, okay, maybe here's some tears. And here's some more laughter. And here's a very interesting thing. And here's a funny thing. And that was cool. But as far as my own talk goes, I didn't want to write it. I didn't know what I'd say. So I'd come up with excuses. Like one of them was, I need to go to Walmart. I ought to do that right now instead of write the talk. So I went over to Walmart and they didn't have what I wanted. So I was like, oh, okay, well, I guess that's my answer. I better be working on that. Oh, wait, there's another Walmart. So I drove another 10 minutes to the next Walmart, just all because I didn't want to write this eulogy. I didn't want to write my part. I started writing it the night before the funeral. I was after the viewing, and the kids were all watching this thing called Storage Wars, which is a reality show on one of those channels that only shows reality shows. And because they only show reality shows, they have the freedom to do marathons of their shows. And so it was a marathon of Storage Wars. And I don't have any interest in any reality shows. There have been some, like the one that Ben Affleck and Matt Damon did. I would have been interested to watch that. Kevin Smith has a reality show that I would have been interested to. But I can't waste my time with that stuff. I have so many other things. I have books that I need to read. And oh gosh, I would so much rather watch a book than read a reality show. I sort of did that on purpose. But because I didn't want to write this talk, I kept watching Storage Wars. And I, in the back of my mind at first, it was like, okay, well, when this half hour show ends, then I'll write the talk. But the half hour ended and it was still on. And I was like, oh, okay, sorry. When this hour show ends, then I'll write the talk. But little did I know that it was a 7-hour Storage Wars marathon. And the kids just kept watching it. And I said to them a couple of times, hey, guys, I really got to focus on this. Can you turn it down a little? And then I'd find myself walking out of the dining room where the table was. This was in my dad's house. We had all gone there. We all decided we were going to spend the night in this house where I grew up, one last night because the funeral was so early in the morning and it's just right there in town that let's all spend a night in our old house. But I got up and I walked over to watch the TV because I became interested in this junk that these people were finding in storage lockers, and whether it was junk or not, and oh, I'll bet that's worth something. And if we made a game of it where they'd see something and we'd all try and guess how much it was worth. I don't regret that because it was, you know, it was a way to pass the time, except for all of them had time to waste and I didn't. I had to do this thing. And so finally, I said to my nephew and my niece and my sister, you know, hey, okay, this is the last one, all right, guys? And then I got to start writing this thing. And my sister understood what I was saying, and so she took my niece and they went downstairs. But my nephew just kept watching it. And that's not a slight against him. It's just he doesn't know me well enough to know what I was hinting at. And he just kept watching it, and I kept not writing the talk. You know, I'd write like a sentence, and then I'd look over for 4 minutes, and then I'd write another sentence, and then, hey, this is interesting. Then the commercials would come on, and I could focus on the writing, except the commercials were louder than the show. And I know that they do that on purpose, but seriously, dude, I'm going to be waiting for them in hell for doing that. It's not cool. The show just kept going. I was fine with it because my brother came over and he had gone over to my aunt's house to comfort her. And so he came over to tell me what they had been saying over there. And then we sort of hashed out some of the strife that had been going on in the family and our worries about how this was going to affect various members of the family and whether there'd be infighting or not. And I know that my brother had to get this off his chest because he and I don't talk. We're not close. And he talked for a long time. And I would say a few sentences and then he would talk again. I know he needed to get it out. And that's good. That's fine. I'm glad I could help. But it was after 1 in the morning and the funeral was at 9:30 at this point, and I still hadn't written my talk. Plus, my aunt had given me at the viewing her part of the talk and I still needed to type it up. But that was fine. He and I talked for a little while, and then he's like, okay, I'm beat, I'm going to go to bed. And so he went, and then I said, hey, can we turn off the TV? I mean, it's getting pretty late. And I realized that my nephew had fallen asleep a long time before, that nobody had been watching Storage Wars, just me. And it bugs me. But then it was time to write the talk, and I wrote it, and I compiled it, and I had this program on my laptop, which I've told you about, that tells how long something is, how many words and all that. But it also tells you how long it would be read aloud. And I realized, oh man, this is going to be a really long talk. Hence, this is going to be a really long wedding. Funeralist. Sorry. They're so similar, guys. You know, the only thing worse than a funeral is a wedding, because at least I know I'm going to die. It's one of my more famous sayings, so I just wanted to repeat it. But I got it done, all compiled. It was 10 pages long, single-spaced. So I went to print, and the printer wouldn't work. It said printer offline. So I went on the internet, and mind you, this is in the farm town where I grew up, so the internet it's so slow that if more than one person is trying to be on the internet at the same time, then it crashes. I was trying to download the driver for this particular printer for my laptop. And it said it would be 40 minutes to download. And it ended up probably being less than that because I was finishing up the talk and went and changed and all that stuff. And I looked and there were still 17 minutes left. So it was probably less than 40. But still, I couldn't wait 17 minutes because by this point it was 2:10, 2:15 or something like that. So I said, okay, well, here's the thing. I'll wake up tomorrow. I'll just print it out, you know, while I'm brushing my teeth or something, and it'll be good. But the next morning, I checked, and it still said printer not found. And when I installed the driver, it wouldn't find it. And so we had to go to a next-door neighbor. Oh, the cousin that I mentioned. We went over there, and I couldn't get her printer to show up on my laptop either. So I emailed the talk to my cousin's husband, and he opened it, and we hooked up the printer to his computer, and we printed it. And it was running short of ink, and it was only printing every other line of the document. And my brother had gone over there, I don't know why, just as moral support or whatever, but he was just like, ah, can't you just read off the laptop? Oh, yeah. And I said, yeah, I could, except for the battery on my laptop lasts about 14 minutes. And if it died while I was trying to do the eulogy, then I would throw it against the wall in front of all those people, which is not cool. And I said, but as long as there's a place to plug it in, yeah, we'll do that. And then I thought, well, let me try one other thing. And so I changed the speed of the printing, you know, where instead of a quick print, which is what it was set up on, is, you know, like, okay, this is the final version with the highest quality ink, and it worked. It worked so it was legible. It took forever, but it was fine, and I got that done. And so that was there, and I guess that's the story of the very lengthy funeral eulogy. Oh, I guess I'd better finish this thing up. It's part podcast, part journal entry. I have my share, maybe more than my share, of character defects. Laziness being a big one, a lack of ambition, crippling self-doubt, inability to finish what I've started. And there are people that are worse than me, but there are a lot of successful people out there who overcome or would have overcome these great challenges. And I discovered, a little bit at least, at the funeral, that some of these characteristics that are not positive that are in me were shared by my dad, but he had the intestinal fortitude to keep a job even if he didn't get along with the boss, even if he thought he was smarter than the people he worked with. He had the, what do you call it, selflessness to put away some of his youthful aspirations and dreams because he had a family, because he had people depending on him. He told me years ago to grow up, that I needed to grow up and, you know, join the adult world. And that meant, you know, stop thinking that I could be a screenwriter or work in the movies. You know, that I needed to buckle down and get some kind of job where, you know, it paid more than the rent and it put a little in the bank every week or month, and I could raise a family on it. And from time to time, my mom still, I'll try and impress her because, you know, I get paid X for doing an Abby Hilton book, or I get paid X for something that I sold, and none of that impresses her. I think she knows that I could have done more with my life. But the truth is, because I'm not a dad, because I don't have a family to support, I have fewer responsibilities. I guess I can see that being a disappointment too. For a lot of people, the reason that you're alive is, you know, to find somebody to settle down and make babies. You know what I'm saying? You and your wife create two children that will replace you. And I can kind of see that. Except for, you know, what about the people that have seven children? What about the people, even the people that have three? My brother-in-law, I thought, like Big Anklevich, he had 10 siblings, which is just unforgivable. But yesterday he told me he had 12. Okay, so there you go. As long as there are people like that, then I'm okay having zero. All right? The math will work out. Anyway, I'm sorry. I don't know where that came from. I guess what I was saying is, okay, he's gone. And there was a lot left unsaid between the two of us. There was a lot left undone between the two of us. But certainly the last 10 years, my relationship with my father has gotten a lot better than it was the first, 30. It used to be that he could say something and I would become incensed and super angry. And either I have matured a little bit so that when he said the thing, I didn't fly off the handle. Or he learned to not say those things that come to his mind that would hurt my feelings or anger me or expand the gulf between us. And, I'm going to chalk it up to both, that he did some growth and I've done some growth. And now it's done. I'm never going to be any closer to my father. I guess I could have gone down to his cowboy convention with him. Because in the back of my mind, when I recorded that Travels with Father episode, I thought, oh, maybe I'll do that. Boy, that would be really interesting. And maybe I would gain an appreciation for the Old West and cowboy movies and all that stuff beyond the appreciation that I already have. I mean, Into the Furnace, Birth of a Sidekick, Sidekick's Journey. They may have other elements, but those are Westerns. And I would not have had any interest in them or written them if I hadn't had a father that absolutely loved the Western. But yeah, that's too bad. It's not my world's big regret, but it would have been neat to go to that last convention with him. Not the least of which reason was that he came back on Sunday and Monday he went to the hospital and never came out. I mean, his procedure was Tuesday morning, so maybe it's considered early Tuesday morning, but I just figured it was a day. Everybody's going to pass away. Everybody's going to die. You're going to lose people that are close to you. And if you don't, then that means either no one is close to you or you die first. There's a cliche or there's a saying that in order to become a man, one must bury their parents. And I certainly felt like there was some growth that happened over the last few days. I had to make a couple of decisions that were hard, and there were one or two moments where I had to put my pride away. And that's part of being a grown-up, is that you have to make decisions that are not easy, and then you have to live with the consequences of those decisions. And I know I didn't do everything perfectly over the last 7 days. It's a week later. I started this episode on a Tuesday, the day that my father passed. Oh, it's not even a week. Today is Monday. It's been an insanely long week, just because there were so many things to do and so many issues and problems to solve. But it's over and it's done, and I feel like I'm a little bit more grown up. And, it didn't throw my perspective out of kilter or show me in a new light what I'm supposed to do. I still want to be a writer. I still want to tell stories, scary stories, funny stories, Western stories. I undoubtedly, probably the next story about Ben Parks will be influenced by the loss of my dad. In that story, I'm fairly sure he was already going to meet an old man who becomes a new mentor, and the old man was going to be really, really righteous. Is that the word? Maybe self-righteous. Really pious. Oh, that's the word. And eventually, Ben would discover why he was that way and that he didn't always used to be that way. And I think I'll still tell that story, but it's going to have a different poignancy because of losing my father who was very pious and very no-nonsense, humorless in some ways. And I look forward to that. I look forward to, well, seeing where this crops up. You know what I mean? In my writings. Again, I wish I were just a little better at writing all the time, at continuing to create content, fiction, whatever you want to call it. Because I don't sell a lot of books, but I do sell some. And if I put out every single darn thing that I wrote and put a little price tag on it, that would be a pretty good paycheck right there. Do you know what I'm saying? I mean, assuming that everything sold the way that, you know, Into the Furnace sold or Birth of a Sidekick sold. Things could be worse, and I could be a less prolific writer than I am. Often I compare myself to Abby Hilton's and Brandon Sanderson's and Stephen King's and these people who, they are serious about their writing careers. But I could compare myself to people who don't. I could compare myself to people who write less. You know, you hear about these writers, you know, like Harper Lee that wrote To Kill a Mockingbird, who wrote something and then it just sat unpublished for 40, 50 years. And that, I guess I just compared myself to the author of To Kill a Mockingbird. And that's not cool. But you know where I'm coming from. I compare myself to these people that just, they really work at it. And I feel bad. But I could compare myself to people that just do not give a crap and feel a little bit good. So yes, I have room to grow. Yes, I have room to improve. But I have improved a little bit. I have grown a little bit. My dad never read my book. When I published it, which was just, holy cow, what, 2 months before he died, I thought about sharing it with him. But I was fairly sure he wouldn't like it. Maybe I was cowardly there. Maybe he would have liked it. I don't know. We'll never know. But I was told after the funeral, which I worked really hard on, as hard as I've worked on my writing, I worked on this funeral and the talk and putting everything together. I was told that he would be proud of how it went, of what I did, of what we expressed. And that's not nothing. So I'm going to leave it at that. After the funeral, my brother said that was the world's longest funeral. And maybe this is the world's longest Rish Outcast. I don't know. But it could have been longer. There are issues that I still haven't come to terms with, questions that I still haven't answered, about like how well did we do? Was my dad's suffering necessary? How good was I at telling him goodbye? And the answer to that third question is probably not very good. I would go up to his side and my sisters would just shower him with affection. And I didn't. But I let him know that I was there and that I hoped he would feel better or got some rest. And then I'd go. And maybe he would understand that because he was not an affectionate man. You know, I'm going to choose to believe that he did understand that. That getting in that elevator and going up to the fifth floor, knowing that I was going to either see him suffering or see him not himself, or get up there and he would be asleep and never even know that I came to see him, it was kind of hard. It was unpleasant. It was a task that I didn't enjoy, and then I felt guilty because I didn't enjoy it. I felt petty. I felt selfish. Yet I kept doing it, and hell, I don't know if he appreciated that. On some level, I have to believe that he did. I guess this has probably been the most intimate episode of the show, hasn't it? And I'll put some kind of disclaimer on there in italics, I can already see. Because do you want to see? Do you want to look that closely at me? Do you want to hear me talk about this stuff? And of course, you know, the episode is over, so if you got to this point, then probably you did. But I would not be upset to find out that two or three people said, oh, hey, you know, I didn't listen to that one. Sorry. Two or three people. You know what I mean. The two or three of the five people that would normally have listened to it. I loved my dad, but I was not very good at showing it. And he loved me and was not very good at showing it. When Sting's father died, he wrote this song called Why Should I Cry For You? And it has this line, what would it mean to say, I loved you in my fashion? It's a question. And that never resonated quite as strongly with me as it does now. But this episode has been me talking about my dad, dealing with it in my fashion. And maybe you understand. Maybe you've lost a parent or soon will, or lost somebody else that was close to you, and you understand where I'm coming from. And if so, well, thank you for connecting with me on this level. I'll probably bring this subject up again in the future, because let's say I write a story and I'll say, you know, this story would not have been written had I not lost my father. Or originally this was going to happen in this story and then I changed my mind. Or this little line is in reference to that time in 2016 when my father passed away. I look forward to it. Like I said, hopefully you're still around too. This has been Rish Outfield. And this has been my podcast, and it's produced under a Creative Commons Attribution 3.0 no derivatives license. And basically it just means that it's free and that it's intended to be free. You can't charge for it, but you can do what you want with it. I mean, I hope you don't take it out of context and do some kind of crazy YouTube remix, but it's got a license that allows people to share it, as long as they don't charge for it or say that it's their work. And that Creative Commons license has been pretty neat. It's been pretty good to me.
So we've reached the end of this podcast. Again, an overshare. But I'd spoken to a bunch of people already that talk about what a good man my dad was, what an impact he made on their lives. I could have done a lot worse with who my parents are. And, you know, I'm lucky to have had time with him, time to get to know him, time for us to become friendlier. You know, it's a shame he didn't live to be as old as his mother was or his father was when they died. And, you know, that's too bad. That's time lost. Experiences lost. But Sunday, I talked to him for a while, and we talked about fishing and the last time I went to the cabin and catching all these fish and all of us cleaning the fish. And you know, he just loved fishing. I mean, it was his favorite thing. And my sister suggested that on the back of his headstone, we put "Gone Fishing." I think that's pretty good. I like that. Boy, I'm just rambling. I'm going to stop now. If this has been worth your while, thank you for listening. I'm saying it through a grimace. Every once in a while we'd do a podcast, or we'd say something in a podcast, Big and I. And I'd know when we said it, or he'd know. Oh, this... Okay, you got to cut that part out. So maybe this whole episode is a, oh, you got to cut that part out. We'll see. This has been Rashad Field, and good night.